Enjoy all your favorite sports like never before at BetMGM. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. When you register with BetMGM, you'll get instant access to a variety of parlay selection features, live betting options, and the best daily promotions in the business. And with BetMGM at your fingertips, every play and every game matters more than ever. Place your money line, prop, or parlay bets with the king of sportsbooks today. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. 21 plus and present in Ohio, subject to eligibility requirements. Rewards are non-withdrawable bonus bets that expire in 7 days. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER in partnership with MGM Northfield Park.
This is the story of the one. As head of maintenance at a concert hall, he knows the show must always go on. That's why he works behind the scenes, ensuring every light is working, the HVAC is humming, and his facility shines. With Grainger's supplies and solutions for every challenge he faces, plus 24/7 customer support, his venue never misses a beat. Call quickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
This is a More Than Just Podcast production.
Welcome to this podcast, Season 4, Episode 50. My name is Tim Mitchell, and I am in Woodstock, New Brunswick. Woo-hoo! Along with Jonathan Kuhlein.
I am also in Woodstock, New Brunswick.
We're coming to you live from Woodstock, New Brunswick. We also have Jaime Lupus Jr. on the line in Seattle, Washington.
How's it going?
Going good. Different last week. First of all, Vina is the name of the female character in The Cage, not Luna, as I said on the show last week. And in that show, the Talosians restore Vina's looks and create a pike-like illusion for her. So the character you see walking up into the elevator with her is not, in fact, the same pike. It's a simulacrum. The real pike returns to the ship. Major Barrett also, just I thought was interesting, got third billing on that episode after Nimoy and Jeffrey Hunter. 13 years before Kirk. 13 years before Kirk? I can't remember why I said that. Oh, no, it takes place 13 years before
right.
Kirk's over the Enterprise. All right, and the Apple TV Plus show For All Mankind is actually made by Sony Pictures, not by Apple, as I said last week. And Jaime was asking about the days of the show. Last week, they showed the date 1984 in Episode 3. And in fact, the Newton message pad, which they use as their sort of video phones, didn't debut until 1993. So
what you're saying is that if the Americans had lost the space race, we'd have gotten Newton's 9 years earlier?
Maybe.
Yeah. Who knows? We could have had iPods. Well,
Steve Jobs wouldn't be dead either, right?
So,
I mean, and actually, it's interesting. If you watch the show in the sort of behind-the-scenes stuff, they show newsreels every now and then, and the Beatles are actually getting back together because John Lennon never got shot.
Okay.
Which would have been 1980.
Right? Yeah.
So, yeah, there you go. Lots of interesting little news things that happen in this fictitious verse of...
Does Nixon still resign?
Trying to think. No, so Clinton loses to a woman. Hmm. So one of the characters from the show becomes the president of the United States, right? Hmm. And she's actually gay. Hmm. All right. So in the headlines, I've just got one thing here. Star Trek designer Gregory Jean died recently. And we may not know him, but he did a lot of interesting work on... He was actually on the new Star Trek II that never saw the light of day. He also did a lot of stuff for The Next Generation, The Final Frontier, Undiscovered Country, Insurrection, and Nemesis, as well as work on Deep Space Nine, Voyager. And he's one of the people, you know, the Close Encounters, the one with the big ship? He made that. He designed that ship, part of that ship. And I actually saw that at the National Air and Space Museum. Or I'm trying to remember if that, yeah, that was that one. I saw one of those at the Space Museum. He also worked on Fantastic Four. I don't know which one. He worked on Serenity, Avatar, The Dark Knight, Dark Knight Rises, Oblivion, Interstellar, and also Mulan. So he's quite a bit of work that he's done on on that. Yeah. And then I've got some, Jonathan's got some sad news for me.
Yeah. I felt the need to include this for you, buddy. The news came out this week that the Time Traveler's Wife adaptation on HBO has been canceled after one season.
No.
I know you were extolling its virtues. I was actually just telling my wife on our trip to New Brunswick that you had given it a thumbs up and said you enjoyed it. So
yeah,
it's funny that, I mean, it's a strange one. Like, I mean, it's based off the book. I don't know how far you could carry that story forward, or if they were telling the whole book story in one season. I don't know.
Yeah. Well, I think they hadn't got like in, I mean, spoilers, if you're going to watch it now, I guess there's no point in not spoiling it for you, but because they're not going to get to this part in the story, but apparently they're not together in the end. Mm. And he dies earlier than expected at some point in his 30s or 40s, right? So those are sort of story points that are that they lead up to, but they never really sort of resolve or finish, right? Mm. So that's too bad. Good show. But there is a movie apparently that came out around the same time.
Yeah.
That I can go back and watch, or I could read the book.
My wife did heartily endorse the book. She said it was quite good.
Yeah.
But she said she read some of the author's other work and didn't enjoy it as much.
Oh, okay, cool. All right. Cool. Well, so that's all the headlines. I'll probably link in the show notes here, but I saw something on Facebook about horror in Star Trek and all the sort of, you know, there's a couple of...
The scary episodes?
Yeah, the scary episodes. Like one, there's a Deep Space Nine where there's like, you know, this clown guy and... Or maybe it's TNG. But there's been a few episodes where they get right into the horror of... Because, I mean, this episode we're going to talk about today is pretty much Alien.
Or Predator. Or Jurassic Park.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Okay, cool. So we dive into the main part of the show, which is why we're here. And that's to talk about something Star Trek-shaped. And I can do the recap of Star Trek. And then we can dive into... This episode called All Those Who Wander is the ninth episode in season one, and it starts off with Uhura's log, stardate 2510 Mark 6, and she's talking about how her assignment on the Enterprise has come to an end, and she's tried every department, and now she's, you know, talking about leaving, and they're having a sort of a get-together, just send-off kind of dinner in Pike's apartment again. He's cooked meals for them. And but before they get to that, she tells that the Enterprise is on its way to deliver Vidium power supplies to Deep Space Nine K7. No, sorry, I'll say that again. It's Deep Space K7, which doesn't roll off the tongue as well as Deep Space Nine does, right? So Pike tells that Chia, Lieutenant Chia, and Uhura, cadet Chia and Uhura are done. They've finished their missions, and they're going to be, you know, sending off, and they've had quite an impact on the ship. And he also congratulates, he kind of chastises and congratulates a new ensign, Duke, also as a lieutenant now. He's been promoted. And I think it's interesting that they introduced two characters at the beginning of this episode because, you know, that they're not going to survive the episode. Uhura is bringing her usual self of being a standoffish. She hates goodbye. She tells Oteriga, and Pike comes over at one point and tells her that, you know, she has, in fact, made an impact and that maybe she should, you know, reconsider, I guess, whatever. He doesn't tell her that outright, but I think that's the implication. Meanwhile, Spock, who's up on the bridge, pings the captain, says we got a distress call we need to respond to. And so he says, well, it sounds pretty serious. We should, one of the ships that's been sent out with, a new design has disappeared, and they're the closest ship to investigate. And so he says, well, let's get science and medical down here and check this thing out. So they have come into his ready room to discuss this. And meanwhile, he's doing dishes as they're talking. And La'an shows up. She was off in a therapy session to deal with her anger. And she's questions the captain about the fact, why are you doing dishes if we're having a serious meeting? He said, well, you know, you can do two things at once. And so he hands food to La'an and asks Spock to take over the dishes duty, which is kind of funny, but Spock kind of just, you know, obliges him just blindly and does it. So the Peregrine is the ship that looks very similar to the Enterprise. It's been in deep space. It has made an emergency landing on a Class L Valero Beta 5. And apparently they say it's a Sombra class ship with parts very much like a Constitution class. And actually, when we see it later on in the episode, it looks just like the Enterprise to me. But so they ask what they should do, and Laan advises they send a landing party. And because of the fact that the Enterprise also has this critical mission to go to bring these power cells to deep space station before it goes dark, you know, she suggests that they do that while the Enterprise delivers. They take a landing party down to investigate while the Enterprise goes off and delivers the power cells. You know, parody back to him that, you know, you can't do two things at once. So two shuttles head down. The crew complement, from what I gathered, was Pike, Spock, Chapel, Hemmer, Mbega, La'ana, Chia, and Duke. And one more.
Sam Kirk, yes.
Forgot about him. So Spock tells him there's a storm coming in 6 hours, and there's an ice storm coming, and it's a pretty cold planet. And Hemmer remarks that it reminds me of Andoria. He's got a big smile on his face, kind of thing. Apparently, this ionic interference is blocking the communication, and that's why the ship wasn't able to communicate. That, you know, when it crashed, and of course now the ship can't communicate with the Enterprise as well. And Spock tells him about this and refers to Duke as Ensign, at which point Chapel says, you owe him a drink, because apparently there's another game where if you miscall somebody after they've been promoted, you have to buy that person a drink as apology, because he's a lieutenant now. And, you know, Spock makes a comment about the fact there seems to be no limit to human drinking games. And she says, yep, there's no limit at all. So meanwhile, they're scanning around. They can't find any life signs. They think it could be interference. And then as they're walking along, they come across blood streaks, and they realize that maybe it's our friends the Gorn are back at it again. And then that's the beginning of the show. We head off to the intro title feed. So getting onto the ship, they find that the environmental systems are down to 20%, and the bridge is completely offline. And someone has hardwired all the controls to engineering. And so Hemmer suggests that they could use the warp core for emergency power. So all this sort of these facts are being relayed to Pike from Spock and Uhura and Hemmer, and he remarks that he's brought the right people because of their ability to make this quick assessment. So looking for the crew, they're trying to figure out where the 99 crewmen that were on the ship have gone, and maybe they were lost in the dark or something like that. And then Kirk, Chaplin, and Chia find the bodies all sort of scattered about and blood stained and sort of, you know, just basically dismembered and in not a great shape. And who could have done this? One of them remarks. Or what could have done this, I guess. So they're listening to the log of the Peregrine, and they find that... They mentioned that they had found a young girl, sort of similar to like La'an, like where she was like the sole survivor of her capture from her people's capture by the Gorn, a humanoid of some description and an Andorian. And they decided to bring them on board. They find that the Andorian was infected with Gorn eggs, and which the biofilters didn't detect, which is another da da da. And the Andorian tries to kill himself by getting himself in engineering and blowing himself up to sort of, you know, get rid of all these Gorn that are inside of him. And that's what triggered the automatic distress call. And I think the captain who was speaking at the time was saying that if she had any choice, she would tell Starfleet to stay away. So it's very similar to the beginning of the Alien movie, where they find this crashed ship and they have to try and investigate what's going on. And there's these, you know, alien bodies that embed themselves inside you and gestate and all that kind of stuff. So very similar. So Uhura, as they're reading the thing, has discovered that there are two life signs down on deck 5. So they go to investigate. So Pike, Uhura, and Laana find the unknown alien dude, and he's got his weapon drawn on him, and they assume he may be protecting someone or something. That's what Uhura surmises from his body language, and they decide to put their weapons down to calm him down, and he leads them into another room where they find, in fact, a little girl.
Yeah, and it's a rare circumstance where the universal translators don't work, right? Usually there's some way to bridge the gap. I love when they turn to her and say, like, what's he saying? She's like, that's not how this works.
Yeah, yeah. It's not how linguistics works, yeah. And it's Yeah, it was interesting. Yeah, because I guess the thing about it is that this dude is talking to them, and the universal translator has no way to fix any kind of thing of what he's saying, right? So, meanwhile, Chapel and Spock are discussing, among other things, they start discussing about Vulcan temper, and she says, you know, to him in her sort of advisory way that she's always doing with him, you know, sometimes it's good to get angry every now and then. And meanwhile, Hemmer and Uhura are back discussing, as they often do, her path and what she's doing and where she's going to go now that she's graduated, what she's going to do. And he says to her sort of wisely, you know, your real fear seems to be putting down roots, and your skill is that you're very good at making connections between people. So you should probably consider that in your whatever you decide to do. And Vega says the readings that they have show nothing. They don't find any signs of any kind of alien or Gorn or whatever. And Lahan just digs into the kid and says, or whose name is, I've got Miranda written down, but it's Orianna.
It's Orianna, yeah.
Yeah, Orianna. Mm-hmm. She asks her, you know, where's the Gorn? What have they done? And all that kind of stuff. And it's funny because Umbega jumps in and says, stop, you know, harassing my daughter. Then he realizes his mistake and says, you know, I meant the girl. Lana says that basically to her, these are basically refugees from the Gorn planet, somehow released or whatever. So the little girl calls the alien Buckley, and Buckley starts wheezing and coughing and whatever. And Chapel starts to investigate him and notices some sort of oozing sort of blood-like stuff underneath the seams of his clothing. And the girl, looking at this and seeing, recognizing what's happening, cowers behind the corner and puts both hands over her mouth to prevent herself from screaming or bursting out. And of course, the Gorn, just like in the dinner scene in The Alien, burst out of him and immediately attack Chia. And then they start attacking each other. And meanwhile, Chapel runs and jumps onto a medical bed and immediately turns on a containment field to protect herself. And then starts, you know, after it settles down and they run away, calmly goes looking for the little girl. So meanwhile, one of the Gorn that gets loose attacks Lieutenant Duke in front of Pike and Spock, who've gone to help him with some burns. And, you know, Pike says, grab hold of him, and he grabs a hold of him, and as Spock does, the creature, the Gorn, whatever, drags Duke away, and Spock's just left there looking at his hands, covered in blood, wondering what's going on, right? So anyway, Chapel continues to look for the girl, and Alana sort of does a count in her head. She says, well, we saw four Gorn born. One of them got killed immediately by the other Gorns, and so the three will grow and start to fight to establish dominance until there's one, you know, sort of leader, the alpha one. And somehow these Gorn have found a way to avoid the Starfleet sensors, so they have no way of finding them, so they just have to mentally count them. So La'ana and Chapel go looking for the girl, and they find her in the coldest part of the ship, because apparently the Gorn hate cold, and La'ana comments that's where I would go looking for them. Kirk wants to run for the shuttle and, you know, make a run for the shuttle and get out of there, and Hammer makes a comment, at that point the comms come back online, because Uhura has been working on them. And so Pike calls all the crew to sickbay now that they've found that it is in fact the Gorn, and they need to get to gather the crew together rather than having them separated. And unlike the movie Alien, where they all separate and get taken out one by one. a large Gorn attacks Hemmer and kind of like spits at him and hits him in the neck. And Hemmer remarks that he's having trouble sensing them as well, even with his telepathy, right? And then Kirk, you know, and Spock makes some sort of like fascinating comment or interesting or whatever. And Kirk gets angry at him. This is Sam Kirk, not Captain Kirk or William, whatever, Tiberius Kirk, James Tiberius Kirk, his brother. Attacks Spock and calls him a heartless, pointy-eared computer, you know, which Pike, you know, hey, get that out. Anyway, so like he's already starting to show some of his vitriol for Vulcans.
Yeah, he's doing his best Bones McCoy, right? That's something like Bones would have done in the original series.
True, yeah. So they decide they have to kill the Gorn before they grow too big, because by the time, if they wouldn't be able to take on an adult Gorn, according to La'ana. And She says we need to get them to attack us. And so they can't resist aggressive behavior. So we have to get angry with them and that kind of stuff. So Spock finds one and it's not responding to him. So he decides to I guess as a way of turning off his Vulcan calmness and turns on his Vulcan rage and attacks the Gorn and gets it in the corner. And meanwhile, another one starts coming after Spock when it notices this and tries to box them in. And at which point, Sam Kirk pulls him back and behind a door and rescues Spock for all intents and purposes. And the two Gorn take care of each other, I think, right?
Well, one kills the other. Yeah.
One kills the other. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So Laan gets one to chase her as she's running down a hallway, and she jumps into a pod, which then slams shut, and then Hammer, who's also on engineering, I guess, blasts it with a freezing ray or spray or whatever, and basically becomes frozen, at which point, you know, of course, she climbs out and smashes it with a shovel, as you do. And then Hammer realizes that been hit with, he knows his body pretty well, and he definitely feels that he's got the Gorn has infected him, and so he needs to go and take care of himself. And they're all like, you know, don't do it. We'll find a way to cure you. And he's like, no, I have to go outside. So he goes and stands. I think he just goes out. He doesn't take a bomb with him, but he goes and walks through the force field, and he's standing on the edge of the ship and saying his goodbyes to them kind of thing. And he turns to Uhura and he says, Uhura, you know, make a home for yourself among others and you'll find more joy than sadness. And that's his advice to her, to, you know, sort of give up on trying to figure out where she's going to go and just, you know, find some people, get with them. And then he just jumps off the ship and you see like this little tiny body falling into the abyss.
Yeah, very dramatic.
Yeah. And then you see the Enterprise towing the Peregrine back to Federation space with a tractor beam. Now they clear all the Gorn off of it. And they all, you know, they're all lamenting about losing him and what he's done for them. And Uhura talks about how, you know, he's kind of helped her get through her sort of broken state. And his, because he mentions in a couple of episodes ago that his purpose is to fix what has been broken. And so he's done that. So in the sort of ceremony for him, you see Spock leave and Chapel goes after him. And he's having trouble controlling the leftover emotions now that he's released them in himself. And he's kind of punching walls. And he kind of, you know, when Chapel approaches him, he kind of grabs her to hold her back. And she explains to him that, you know, these emotions are, you know, like the fact that you're Vulcan is that you can't control them. That's not the problem. What it is, these are what make you human. And she gives him a big human hug. And that seems to resolve his issues, right? And as we leave this, so we've lost Hammer already in the show. And then Laana comes up to Captain Pike and tells him that she's got a lead on Oriana's family. And she wants to leave and go outside of Federation space to try and track down this family. And she asks basically for a leave of absence, you know, or decommission me or whatever. And so Pike just sort of says, yes, you know, and then come back to us, you know, when you can, kind of thing. And as the show ends, we see Uhura going up to the bridge, and she turns towards the comm station where we find, you know, Nichelle Nichols, you know, a few years later, as we fade away. So obviously Uhura has decided that she's going to try comms as a career and become the communications officer. And that's where the episode ends.
Mm-hmm. I was bummed to see Hammer go out. Because I liked his personality and what he brought to the show. It seems like they gave him an arc here, though, to set Uhura on the right path to where we know she ends up, right there in the comms chair.
Yeah, it's a bit of a sacrifice, though, right?
Yeah, yeah. He Lieutenant Ripley's himself at the end of Alien 3.
Yeah, it's there was a lot of echoes of other things in this one. We joked obviously about it being a little bit of Alien or Aliens. There's definitely Predator in there because the way that we see the
screen, yeah.
The screen when we're supposed to be seeing it from the Gorn point of view looked very Predator-y. And then the way that they sort of move and attack felt very much like the Velociraptors from Jurassic Park, right? Mm. They kind of, way more so than what we see in the original series when like an adult Gorn wearing clothing is attacking
speaking
Kirk.
To them in the microphone.
Yeah. Mm. Very different.
Yeah, people were wondering about that online, but I'm like, well, let me introduce an idea to you, right? Because people were like, how do these beasts become, you know, something that Kirk is going to axe chop at some point in the future. And I think, you know, and they clearly, we've seen that they can pilot starships and plan out things. And I'm like, well, maybe they're meant to be kind of like frogs or butterflies, which, you know, if you show, like, just go pick a young child who's never like seen these things and be like, hey, you see this tadpole? You see this frog? Yeah. They're the same species. And you see this caterpillar and you see this butterfly, they're the same species. So like, what? No, you're a liar. They're not even closely the same. At least, you know, puppies turn out to be dogs and kittens turn out to be cats, right? But maybe there's some sort of metamorphosis that happens where these Gorn go from, like, you know, crazed animals into capable thinking beings that know physics and calculus.
Yeah, it definitely feels like... It seems a little short-sighted to assume that, I mean, they establish right off the hop, Lon says that they are super intelligent even at birth, right? Like, they're very, very intelligent species. So it's not really that far to figure. I mean, the ones we saw using, like, incredibly reasoned thinking and behaving, you know, the way that they were, like, hours old. Of course, if these things live a little longer and they're that smart, they would... be able to manage those things. I think you just have to like realize that they're on like a super trajectory. You know, human beings were obviously were slow developing species, but these ones clearly come out really smart and then continue to be really smart. So I don't think it's a huge leap to see them becoming the interstellar traveler creatures if this is what a newborn is like.
Right. Yeah.
It was a strange episode. You know, obviously this is the penultimate episode. We've got one more in the season. So, you know, I remember hearing a comment from one of the showrunners who sort of said, you know, we weren't ready to bring Scotty on right off the hop. This obviously sort of clears the path with Hemmer's death, maybe either next episode, but more likely.
Oh, because it gets her to Lon and...
Yeah, I mean, Hemmer. So I don't know. Who was the security officer on the original Enterprise? There really wasn't anybody identified.
It was like Spock, or Scotty. Scotty was sort of in charge of that. He was like the red shirt leader, right?
Yeah, I guess. So he was kind of both of those jobs, right? So maybe this is all just, you know, the two characters have their arcs. They're pretty satisfying arcs, all things being equal.
There's no more red shirts on the bridge crew, right?
Well, Uhura.
Yeah, but I mean, Lana wore one.
Yeah.
And Hemmer wore one.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. So I think this is, you know, in one way, even I was like, I mean, they kind of telegraphed the Hemmer stuff a little bit that, you know, maybe he would. I didn't necessarily think he was going to die, but I thought there might be some sort of like something big happening there. I mean, Chia and Duke were doomed from the moment they introduced them and gave them names, but. Having this sort of be all sort of set up for Hemmer to have this arc where he sort of helps Uhura find herself is pretty satisfying, I thought, all things being equal. I mean, I agree with you, Jaime. I think he was a good character, and I would have liked to have seen him do more. But I think if we reflect on sort of the beginning, middle, and end of what we've seen, it's a good one-season arc for a character. He's a memorable character. And beyond that, to obviously have the actor portraying him be, you know, visually impaired and be the first performer to be visually impaired on the show, that's a nice milestone as well.
Was he actually?
Yeah.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh.
And, but then I felt a little different about Lon in that the fact that they introduced her as, you know, her last name and the legacy that that brings and everything else, and that if she leaves this and doesn't come back... That feels unsatisfying.
Right.
In a different way. Like Hemmer, I feel like I never, like, obviously I'm disappointed. We'd like to see the character more, but his arc is a satisfying one. Her arc without more doesn't feel satisfying.
But the thing about it is, like, in season two or whatever, the Botany Bay episode, it won't fit with Nguyen Singh being there.
No, of course. But then she could still be there on the ship for years to come. Are we supposed to be sort of satisfied with her arc? And I don't even know for sure that this was her last episode. Who knows? But if this is the last time we see her, are we satisfied that we sort of met her? She was, you know, angry. She had this thing against the Gorn. We got some of her backstory. She's now going to help this other girl reunite with her family in the same situation. Is that a satisfying arc for either of you?
No.
No, I don't think so. Do we know if there's any... real world implications for the actress? Like, is she signed on for something else and so they had to write her into a special guest star for season two or something?
Yeah, I don't think I think now that you have these sort of series, I don't think they're writing them in a sort of episode by episode kind of way. They probably have the whole season written. So when you sign the contract, you know that you're going to leave, your character's going to die, your character's going to go off to space or whatever. Because you're right, it is a lot of investment for us as an audience to sort of get attached to people like La'ana and Hammer, and then you know, to not have them. They're kind of pivotal in the show. Also, I mean, does this also lead them opportunity to have the Strange New Worlds canceled after season one and not leave loose ends to many, you know? Because I mean, there's also, if you look at the Cage, which I'm going to talk about in the picks or in the watch list, there's the older doctor dude. That's how they fit him in, and you know, like the bridge crew on the Cage are quite different than what we have here, other than number one and Spock.
Yeah, I mean, I there's still room to grow, and they could introduce entire new characters next season that have seasons long arcs and then still leave before we catch up to where the original series picks up.
Yeah,
I don't know. I mean, I'm just taking a quick scan around. I don't see anything about her why or her leaving or anything like that. I just, yeah, it's a strange thing. It's a strange arc. I'm still, until I see characters, you know, die in the way, spectacular way, like we saw Hammer die, obviously the door's open for them to come back. So it's possible that, you know, her story arc is that this is the end of it, but then she dramatically returns next season, or who knows what. I don't think that's out of the question. But I thought she was great. I thought she was a really good performer, and I think her character was interesting. One of the more interesting new characters they introduced. And yeah, it'd be disappointing if this is all we sort of get from her. And one episode to go.
Yeah, it seems like a short season still, even 10 episodes, right?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. We used to get 22 episodes per season.
Yeah, well, but then we also used to do the rule of threes too, right? So if you had 22 episodes, you got
three good ones, three crap ones. And
yeah, you got seven good ones, seven okay ones, and seven crap ones.
And seven, yeah, shore leaves.
Yeah, so I'm happier that they do these nice tight seasons. Like, as I said last week, like last week was not my favorite episode, the one where they did the whole, you know, medieval theme in the ship and stuff like that. But even that was a good episode. It wasn't, you know, like they haven't made a bad one yet, which is pretty impressive. I can't say the same about Picard, and I can't say the same about Discovery. Both of those have had duds.
True.
So far, there isn't a bad episode of Strange New Worlds.
Even last one?
Again, I didn't like it as much as the other ones, but it was a good episode.
Okay.
We definitely got some progress on Mbenga and his character arc, and I'm glad that they touched on that again this one. I like that they're doing that in so many of these. Like, they did it in Disco and in Picard, too. It's not just, like, one and done, like, oh, well, that's clap our hands off, that's behind me. They're actually like, yeah, I'm still struggling with some of these things.
Well, I mean, the original series, it was the nature of the way TV was produced at the time. They basically would write one episode and it was self-contained, you know?
Yeah. But I think this is the best of all worlds, because so far, Strange New Worlds has been episodic television, but there is character growth and there is ties that bind the whole thing together. Again, we talk about Hammer's arc from episode one to episode nine. There's progression for him. You know, we understand.
Episode two, he wasn't even in episode one.
That's true. He doesn't come to the end, right? Mm-hmm. So, yeah. So, I mean, we definitely got some progression, and the same with Lon, right?
Were you guys able to see the preview for episode 10? I don't know how you guys encounter those. I don't know if you have ready room available somewhere. So
no, they haven't put those out yet on the Crave. They don't put those on there.
Okay. So it's interesting that unless there's a pretty wild turn in episode 10, the tease for Cybok looks like it is unresolved this season, because the next episode, the ultimate episode of season one here, is apparently going to focus on the Pike prophecy, just given the preview that they gave.
Yeah, I wonder if the Cybok thing is meant to be something they're going to build on in coming seasons, or if that was just supposed to be like, oh, we acknowledge that he exists, so therefore it makes sense that Star Trek V makes sense.
Yeah, it could be. I wonder about that too.
But it's the same thing. Like, as much as I'm really, really enjoying the show, and I am, I think this is one of the best pieces of Trek we've seen so far since sort of the Trek revival, but there is going to be some challenges. Like, they've already delved into the relationship between Spock and his fiance, which we know doesn't really come to a head until the original series, yeah. Right? So how do you end that satisfactorily for people who haven't necessarily watched the original series, but are watching this and enjoying it? How do you get that to a place where it makes sense to conclude their arc? And there's a few things like that. Again, the Chapel-Spock relationship. Some of these things, I'll be curious to see how they try and land them, because they can't just be focused on bridges to the original series, because some of these arcs don't finish till the original series, so they can't wrap them up here.
Yeah. Well, I mean, there are some inconsistencies, though. I mean, Spock is very cold and aloof in the original series. Here, he's a little bit more
emotional,
exploring his roots and understanding emotion and stuff like that, whereas in the original series, for obvious reasons, he's more straightforward Vulcan, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So just to be mysterious.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, well, there remains to be seen. It's hard to sort of see this stuff fit into, you know, where we come from. Again, the prequel problem.
Welcome back to the prequel problem.
Back to the prequel problem.
So rename this podcast, the prequel problem.
Yeah. How about we talk about Ms. Marvel now?
Ms. Marvel. Okay. I will just give a quick rundown on Ms. Marvel. So we pick this one up after the end of episode 3, where we have both Kamala and her grandma having the same vision of this train, and her grandma saying, you have to come to Karachi, you have to come here, and we have to work through this together. So we pick this one up on the flight to Karachi. She's on the plane. For some reason, she's not sitting right next to her mom. She's sitting like with a space in between them, which I took to mean that her mom was like, I'm still mad at you and I don't want to sit next to you, but it was kind of funny.
Or it's the last flight they could find, right?
Yeah, maybe, maybe. But it was, a little funny scene where, you know, they agree that they're going to sort of, you know, put aside the bad feelings after the wedding and, you know, what's going on. And they're going to try and enjoy their trip to Karachi. They land in the city, and the cousins come to meet them, and they take them to Kamala's grandma's house, where, there's a really nice, you know, she gets the tour around and she sees that her nanny, her grandma, is, you know, painting her memories, because she has all these, you know, memories of her childhood and memories of the partition between India and Pakistan. And, you know, she's sort of, you know, trying to sort of figure out, you know, try and dissect her past. And it leads to a really good conversation between Kamala and her grandmother, where she sort of says, you know, so this bangle, what's going on with it? What's going on? And, you know, am I a djinn? And her grandma responds very bluntly, of course you are. But why, you know, that's just genetics. What does that have to do with anything? And of course, you know, it's not the answer that Kamala's looking for. She's pretty upset at, you know, finding out that maybe she's not, you know, a human being, and she's not sure what she is. They talk about, you know, she talks again about the miracle, the trail of stars that her grandmother followed back to her dad on the day of partition to get on the right train to get to Karachi to make sure that she could be safe. And from there, we sort of pick back up this whirlwind tour of Karachi. Kamala's cousins come to pick her up, and they're all going to this boat club. And then, of course, Kamala's wearing jeans, and they're not allowed inside the club because the boat club doesn't allow jeans. And so they're sitting outside, and they're miserable, and they're not really happy with her. And she's sweating, and then, you know, one of her mom's friends pops by and sort of says, oh, you're sweating. It must be because you're wearing those jeans. She's like, no, it's because of the pani puri that I'm eating and I'm cooking. So again, another sort of illustration of the fact that she's an Americanized, a person of Pakistani descent, right? And so she and her cousins are touring around Karachi, and her cousin makes a point of pointing out that she's an ABCD, right? She's an American-born confused Desi. That's what it is, confused Desi. Desi is a person who's obviously, who's Indian, who is not living in India or Pakistan, a person who's of Indian descent or Indian Pakistani descent, but not living there. And yeah, so she's, you know, a little miffed that they keep sort of treating her like she's very much an outsider, which of course she is. She was born in America and has, you know, American life experience, and this is all new to her. While they're doing their tour, she sort of says, you know, how about we go look at the train station? And they're like, how about you go look at the train station? We're going to go and meet up with our friends and you can catch up with us later. At the train station, she's sort of poking around. She's trying to sort of figure out if there's any clues that she can find there related to the train and her vision. When she's there, this this sort of mysterious young man with a red mask comes out, and you know, they have a little superhero tussle where he's, you know, throwing knives at her and she's using her powers to block them. And she's definitely showing a lot of progress from the very inexperienced version of her that we saw in the last couple episodes. She's using the ability to, yeah, she's making shields and she's using platforms, and yeah, she's definitely coming along. She drops the funny line where he's like, you know, you're, you know, pretty good fighter for, you know, an American. She says, how do you know I'm not Canadian? Which I thought was really funny because obviously, Iman Vellani is Canadian. I thought that was a great line. Anyway, it turns out that, you know, they're on the same side. The two of them, take off out of there, and they are, going to, he takes her to the hideout when she finds out about the Red Daggers, which is this secret society that are used, to keep people safe and also to, sort of keep the hidden dimension hidden. And so she finds out that there's this sort of alternate dimension that overlaps with ours, and it's behind the wall of Nur, or light. And yeah, she basically is trying to sort of figure out, you know, what this sort of, how this all sort of ties into her and her family's backstory and everything else. We cut to the Supermax prison where they have transported the clandestines, the djinn, who got captured by damage control at the end of the last episode. And they're held apparently for about 5 seconds before they, you know, beat up some guards and escape. Not my idea of a Supermax prison, if that's the case. That seemed awfully easy to get out of. There's like two guards. There's not even enough guards to line up for the number of people that they're escorting. It's bad math.
Right.
But yeah, so that they all escape. And beyond that, as they're escaping, they leave Kamran behind. His mother basically says, we can't trust him. He clearly was there to protect Kamala. Mm. You know, you're out of the gang. And so he gets kicked out. We go back to Karachi, and we find out that the young man who's wearing the mask, his name is Karim, but he goes by Kimo. He takes Kamala down to meet some friends, and they're on the beach. They have this bonfire. They're eating biryani out of a bag, which is really interesting. But she's all worried that it's going to be spicy, but then she finds out that it's really good and she's really enjoying it. And so you get that sort of connection that she's like, yeah, these are my people. I get this. Okay. And yeah, so she goes and she is doing that. Meanwhile, back at her house, there's a sort of a conversation going on between her mom and her grandma, her Ami and Nani, and they're talking about, you know, hey, maybe it's time for you to come live with us in America. Maybe there's, you know, time for you to stop living in this big mess. And, you know, they talk about why she left, why Kamala's mom left. And she's like, well, you know, everybody was making fun of me because they thought my grandma or my mom had these crazy theories, and you know, I needed to get away from you, frankly. And so it's, you know, it's a good scene, kind of cathartic for the, you know, you can tell that her mom's kind of got some stuff going on and some issues with her mom and stuff. So it's good to get the backstory on that. We go back to the headquarters of the Red Daggers, and that's where we see Kamala gets her Shalwar Kameez, the sort of very light but very durable vest that she wears, which is, for people who are fans of the comics, is part of her comic outfit. So again, we still haven't seen her. We've seen her get the mask that she got from Bruno, and then we've seen her get the Shalwar Kameez, but she's slowly putting together what we recognize as her costume. At this point, you know, in a stunning twist of fate, the clandestines have apparently flown from America to Pakistan in like a nanosecond and attack. And they go in there. There's this, you know, huge chase scene, really well done, good chase scene, I thought, where they're sort of chasing them through the streets of what is supposed to be Karachi, but apparently was filmed in Thailand. And they have this whole, you know, we've got to split up. Kamala steals a truck at one point and runs one of them over. It's pretty funny. We end up with Walid, the leader of the Red Daggers, getting involved, and he's trying to help them to escape. Najma, the Kamran's mom, ends up killing him as part of the, you know, he makes the call to, I have to save them, so he uses his last two knives, throws them into the wall. They use those to escape, but then he doesn't have anything to defend himself, and Najma kills him. And in the same interaction, one of the clandestines, the guy with the huge club, ends up getting killed too. And as part of this, we also end up with Kamala is trying to defend herself, and the bangle that she wears on her wrist that helped unlock her powers gets stabbed. She finds herself seemingly traveled back in time to the day of partition, and she finds herself in India, back standing in front of that train that she had in her vision, and it's the last train to Karachi, and she's like, what the heck am I doing in 1948?
Yep.
And so time lost Kamala is where we end the episode.
Timey-wimey,
it had to be coming. I mean, that train vision seemed like it was sort of telegraphing that. Mm-hmm. What'd you think, Jaime?
I like the episode. I have noticed a pattern where you can like honeypot our main character. Like if you've got like an attractive dude, she is like willing to trust you, no questions asked.
Right? It sort of worked out. Like she turned Kamran against his mom, and this guy was like, you know, willing to defend her to the death. So she's actually doing okay, batting average wise.
Yeah, yeah. It's not been a real problem yet, but it does seem like a weird character flaw that is somewhat unique to a teenage character. So,
what's the male female equivalent to honeypot? By the way, is it still honeypot?
I think so. I'm not sure.
Honeypot's an IT term too, right?
Is it?
Yeah, it's like how you catch spammers. Uh-huh. You give them something in a form that doesn't really mean anything and have them put the information in it. It's kind of like, you know, get the bear to come after the honeypot.
There you go.
The other thing that I think I saw people online are like, oh, look at this weird flaw. Like, you know, she and her mother arrived at Karachi Airport in somewhere pretty late at night, because the mother even says to the grandmother, oh, you shouldn't be awake, right? And when they arrive by car to the house, it's morning, you know, it's somewhere around daybreak. And I'm unfamiliar with Pakistan, to be honest, but from the many folks I've known who've gone to India, you're not necessarily flying into Mumbai and calling it good. It's like, now we're making the several hour trip to get to our actual village. So I'm like, it's not unreasonable that you have to drive.
Take a train across the city.
Yeah.
Karachi is massive. Okay, I mean, Karachi is, it's like 15 million people, and it's very spread out.
Yeah, but I mean, like, to go from Mumbai to Calcutta is like a 2-day train ride.
Oh yeah, for sure. Yeah. But I mean, I think the idea is that her mom's supposed to be in Karachi.
Yeah.
So, but yeah, I think even still, I think the idea is that it probably takes a while to get back to her house. But
I did notice the time change and thought that was a bit odd.
Yeah.
Yeah. They don't specify exactly what time. So if it's, you know, 5 in the morning when they've arrived, it's not unreasonable that, you know, an hour and a half drive, it's been daybreak. I don't know what typical, you know, daybreak is, especially that time of the year, but I'm like, yeah. I mean, if they showed it and it looked like high noon, I'd be like, whoa, wait a minute, what happened here? But yeah. Showing up from late night to, you know, telling the grandma, you probably shouldn't be awake, you probably should be asleep, feels like it was at 9, 10 p.m., feels like it was, you know, Your flight from the U.S. sucks coming in flight time-wise, right?
Yeah. So the way that they've set this up, is there any doubt that the whole point is that she goes back in time, creates the the path of stars, the trail of stars that leads her.
Oh,
like that's got to be it, right?
Yeah,
I think so. What's unclear to me is if she's going to knowingly fulfill that that time loop, or if she's going to be achieving some other goal, and it just, you know, through fate or whatever you want to call it, ends up leading her her great grandmother to the right spot. Her grandmother.
Yeah, that's a good point. It may not be intentional, but I think it's guaranteed that she does it. It's the circumstances, I think, is, yeah, mm-hmm, I think it's a good point. Mm-hmm. But yeah, the fact that she sort of appeared there, I was like, oh, okay, so she's going to fulfill the prophecy of, because they mentioned that the path, the trail of stars, like three times in different episodes, like clearly she is part of this legacy, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Still good. I thought, so apparently they didn't film this in Karachi, which is not surprising. They filmed it in Thailand. I saw a brief interview with Imam Balani saying, like, it was as hot as it seems in those things. She's like, it was like the hottest place I've ever been in my life. Again, she grew up in Markham, so sure.
Yeah.
I thought it was like really, like, interesting to sort of, you know, yeah, like take it away from New Jersey City, take it away and do like something that's completely different, especially because it's that beautiful juxtaposition of like, she's from Jersey. That's in her mind. That's where she's from. That's her people. That's what she's used to have her go to the place where her family's from and have it feel foreign for her, the food, the culture that it's foreign to her, is, I think, really interesting. It's a really interesting way to sort of do that. We, you know, the fish out of water thing is not uncommon in storytelling, but it's interesting to see it flipped by having somebody who's obviously a person of color and has a family that's, you know, got their connections to these places, but she doesn't. I thought that was really well done.
Yeah. Yeah.
So how does that compare to the books?
There's a similar story in the books, but not the same. They've really kind of gone a different path from what I read. I brought the books with me to catch up because I haven't read the book after. I read the first book, not the second one. So,
Is it typical to get biryani in a bag? Like, I don't know.
I've never seen it.
Okay. Well, that was like not just her Americanism, Jerseyism. That is like not a necessarily typical thing. Like, I honestly don't know.
But then we saw that in, if you remember the episode of Moon Knight, where they're supposed to be in Cairo, at one point, is it Layla shows up and she's drinking from a bag. She's basically got a straw jammed in a bag, and that's how she bought street drink in Cairo, right? Yeah. So again, I think they're kind of, yeah, trying to use some, like, you know, culturalisms and localisms so that it seems more authentic.
Do you guys do that in Canada? Do you just, you know, go down the store, get a bag of milk and puncture it with a straw and drink straight from the tap? Is that how that works? Because
I'm not going to lie to you, Jaime. I'll be honest. I know we take a lot of flack, and it's only in Ontario that we have the bagged milk like that. Yeah. Other provinces, we're here in New Brunswick, they have jugged milk just like the States does. But
I first had it in Montreal, though.
Yeah,
Trois-Rivières, I think.
I don't think it's everywhere. I think it's just in certain spots. But yeah, the bagged milk thing, I got to be honest, when I was a teenager and I was like growing and had like that need for protein, I'm sure you both had that experience when you were a younger person where you're just like, I need to drink a bunch of milk. We would legitimately do that. We would just like knock the tab off it and just grab one of those bags and knock back.
Really?
Oh, yeah. 100%. 100% we did that.
Oh.
So, yes, the answer is yes. So I had warned you guys last week that the Boys Herogasm comic book was pretty far over the top. How far did it go in your minds, the episode centered around the superhero orgy in the Boys this last week?
Well, as television goes, it was quite out there in terms of like the amount of explicit action you saw. But I mean, no more than you would see in other party scenes, whatever. But the guy with the love dragon or whatever they called it, that was a little bit too far, but especially when it gets charred at the end.
Oh God, yeah.
And the little guy getting squished by Homelander's foot, right? But
then there's the scene where the guy we saw in the first episode who shrinks down, comes up, because he comes up to full size and then he brushes up against,
and then he opens the door and he gets covered in
spray. And he opens the one door and he gets sprayed. Like, there's some pretty over the top stuff in this episode.
That was pretty interesting. But my comment about it was, I was trying to tell, I forget who was talking to you about it, but it's like, it's so,
I mean, it's so much the superhero story that, you know, it's just background music, really. You know, like, it's funny, right? But the struggle between the, you know, the reality of, or thinking about, how would it be if superheroes could actually do this kind of stuff? Like, these were all C-list superheroes having this orgy, right? According to the story. Yep. But it was kind of... It just seemed normal in their life.
It didn't
mm-hmm. seem like mm-hmm. out there. Like, if you walked into a room and people were just like doing it like that, like, you know, thinking of like movies like your favorite Tom Cruise movie, Eyes Wide Shut, or things like that, where you walk into rooms and there's like that going on, and you know,
was
that movie? I think
that movie.
You know, and it's a shock when you first see it, but I think having seen, you know, a person climb into a giant penis in episode one, this is like nothing.
Yeah, it's definitely continues to push the envelope, this show.
Yeah.
But it's funny because the, you know, the crux of this episode around the spectacle of this is, you know, the conflict between Starlight and Huey, and the Annie and Huey, and the conflict for Mother's Milk with, you know, is he on board with what Butcher and Huey are doing?
Yeah.
And
he gets covered in Father's Milk.
Oh God. Thank you for going there. and then beyond that, you know, obviously, you know, it's still tied into the Homelander is a raging lunatic, you know, part of this, where, you know, this just keeps escalating and escalating and escalating. It's, you know, and obviously, you know, the episode, you know, has some pretty serious ramifications. And then, you know, also tied into this is the whole arc with A-Train, right? You know, A-Train has been really struggling with his identity as a black man.
I want you to apologize to me. And he's like, dude, I'm really sorry.
Really sorry.
And he's just like, that's not enough, right?
Yep. But then there's the scene with him and Huey, and that was really interesting. And then there's the scene with him and, what's his name? Guy's name? How many do you remember?
Grinds him into the ground.
Yeah, where he's basically like, enough out of you, you know, and he just drags him to his death and then possibly also dies.
Yeah, also does,
Blue Hawk, I think his name was.
Blue Hawk, thank you, Blue Hawk. Thank you.
That guy needed to die.
He did. I mean, he was clearly a reprehensible scumbucket, but at the same time, like, it may have cost A-Train his life too to make that. But yeah, I mean, to have that moment of catharsis with Huey, where Huey's like, you know, I want you to apologize to me. He's like, I'm really, really sorry. And you think he meant it in that moment. Like, up until now, A-Train has been an unapologetic jackass. And to finally have him, you know, actually look Huey in the eyes and say, I'm really sorry for, you know, killing your fiance, you know, that's a huge growth moment. And then he follows it up with like this spectacular murder and possibly dying. Like that's a lot in an episode with, you know, frozen ice dildos and, you know, Father's Milk.
Yeah.
You know, it's such an interesting show that they can go these, like, you know, the other show that kind of reminds me of is Rescue Me, right? The Dennis Leary show, where there are episodes where you will find yourself laughing with tears and then having tears. Like, it can really take you on that roller coaster. There's not very many shows that can really sort of thread that needle between like really heavy and really light in the same episode and have it all work. This is pretty tricky stuff, and it's working well.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting. Like, there's the violence is so extreme in this show. I mean, you know, the chopping people in half, or, you know, whether it's like with your laser vision or a samurai sword or what have you. I mean, and then having this scene, it just seemed like just another day, really.
Yeah. Wow. More of this, please. More of this show.
Yeah. And did it, I mean, it seemed to be telegraphed that she would quit at the end there. Like, I guess the question is now what happens with Homelander versus her, right?
Well, yeah. Because...
And is Maeve going to come back and help her?
Well, and where is Maeve, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, Maeve, she talked to Maeve just before all this went down. You think Maeve's been taken away by Homelander?
Yeah, because she says in this episode, like, nobody's seen Maeve. Where's Maeve? Because Maeve gets has clearly gone on the wrong side of Homelander, right?
Okay, yeah.
Yeah, so.
But I thought Maeve was tough.
The official story was that she had gone to rehab, I think, is what they said.
Yeah.
Yeah, but when Starlight goes and talks to her, like, an episode ago, she says, yeah, that was just a story, and I've been here getting drunk and working out.
or not getting drunk. She says she's been
building up her a bit, working out, and as opposed to like not working out to get ready to take on Homelander.
Yep. Yep.
Well, let's move on to our watch list. So I've just got one thing real quick here. I don't know. Are we talking about the Crown on this show? Have we talked about it before?
I mean, we've talked about it abstractly.
Yeah, just I think it's interesting that they've just announced the season. And apparently, this isn't the last season of the Crown. Hmm. But the woman who's playing Queen Elizabeth is the pink lady from the Harry Potter series.
Oh.
Yeah. Okay. The real nasty woman.
Yeah. Oh, God, what was her name? Yeah, I know the one.
Dolores Umbridge was the character.
There you go.
This article says Imelda Staunton.
Yep, that's the actress. Yep.
Yeah. Yeah. And then the guy playing Charles is an interesting dude. And a different character, different woman playing Diana. I thought the girl who played Diana in the last season was really good. Mm-hmm. Anyway, and then the other thing that I mentioned at the top of the show was The Cage, where I went back because of, you know, for researching for this show, I was confused about what happened with Pike and Luna. Sorry, not Luna, Vega. And how they managed to get the footage to put together, you know, him walking off happily at the end of the menagerie, right? Well, so I went back and watched this. It's a really interesting and tough episode to watch. What I found really fascinating about it was all that sort of incidental music that they have, like the, you know, the alluring, falling in love with somebody music and all the battle music, all that kind of stuff, is actually in The Cage. Mm-hmm. Like, it's the music and all that kind of stuff, and the characters and the costumes, a lot of that stuff. It was a really amazingly put together pilot, even though it's very disconnected from Star Trek itself. Like, some of the things that they say on the ship, and like how they call it Warp Factor 9, they don't say that kind of stuff. They say it's sort of a weird, you know, weird way of saying it. But other than that, it's very interesting episode to watch, and it just stands out on its own. Like, it stands up as a Star Trek episode goes. So yeah, definitely recommend if you haven't seen The Cage. And they have redone all the spaceship scenes.
Oh,
so really? The cage you see now on Netflix or Disney or wherever it is it Disney or Netflix? I can't remember. But it's, or Crave.
Crave has all the Star Trek content here, yeah.
But it's the new sort of 2008 version. So, but it's okay. I mean, like, you know, I've gotten over the fact that I'll never get to see those original spaceships again.
Unless you own the DVDs.
That's true. Mm-hmm. And I guess we'll throw over to Jaime for the next one.
Yeah.
Again, something we can't watch.
Yeah, I don't know how you're going to end up getting this. I suspect you will at some point. I can't predict what it'll be. The Offer on Paramount Plus in the USA. That is the story of how the Godfather movie got made. All 10 episodes are now available. It is maybe the exception that proves the rule around the prequel problem that we've talked about a lot on this show, and that I don't think this suffers from the prequel problem. Like, spoilers, guess what? They make one of the best movies of all time by the end of the series. It still happens. It's not like an alternate reality thing. But the twists and turns on getting there were pretty interesting. So I definitely recommend that. I would say out of the 10 episodes, the final episode is kind of the victory lap episode, so it feels sort of tonally different than the others, but it's still a pretty enjoyable ride through the first 9 and then seeing the payoff in the final episode.
Yeah, I think it's only available here on Paramount Plus as well. I mean, we talked about how more and more content is being created for that here, and you know, we were lucky that we get Star Trek through Crave and through CTV Sci-Fi, but I think the gravy train of lots of Paramount Plus content has sort of ended with Star Trek, because, yeah, the new South Park stuff, this stuff, it seems like if you want to start watching some of this good programming, you may have to pony up for your Paramount Plus here in Canada, too.
Yeah, they might do, like, a special sort of thing here, like, Yellowstone has been playing here on some channel. It's not on Paramount Plus at the moment. And I believe they're doing this, you know, mini marathon or whatever it is that they're doing, because they want to push people towards the 1883 prequel to the Yellowstone series, which is on Paramount Plus. So wouldn't be surprised if ended up getting it.
I think it's on Amazon Prime for us.
Okay. But I wouldn't be surprised.
Something.
Right. No, I get that. But my point is that I don't think it will necessarily be exclusive to Paramount Plus. You might get an opportunity to see it. Yeah, maybe next Canada Day weekend.
Maybe. I had a couple things for my list. I wanted to sort of scan. So once we get to the first of the month, we find out what is coming to all the streaming platforms. And so I took a look to see what we were going to get that sort of fits our area of interest. I was interested. So I saw one that's not on here is that Spider-Man Homecoming showed up on Disney Plus today here in Canada. And I'm not sure if it's also in the States. I mean, maybe you can confirm that. But that's interesting because that's the first of the new Sony Disney movies to show up there. But then we also got news that Spider-Man No Way Home is premiering if you have the subscription, on Amazon Prime on July 15th here in Canada. We talked about sort of where it might end up, given the fact that it's in that murky Sony Disney, you know, vortex. But yeah, apparently here in Canada, it's available on Amazon Prime starting on July 15th. Mm-hmm. And a couple other nice sort of pieces, things that I want to see, but unfortunately didn't either get to the theater or, you know, make the effort. But Last Night in Soho, the Edgar Wright film, is coming to Crave on July 22nd here in Canada. And I think it might already be on HBO in the States. Or HBO Max. And then Uncharted is coming to Amazon Prime at the end of the month on July 29th here in Canada as well. So there's a few movies in there. I mean, I have only seen No Way Home the one time when we saw it in the theater, so I would look forward to seeing that again. And Last Day in Soho, I wanted to get out, but that was the pandemic was going pretty strong at that point, so we didn't really make an effort for that one. Same thing with Uncharted. I like the ingredients. I've heard mixed reviews, not super high, but I think again, when it's available to stream on your television set at home, it's
probably Uncharted.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, it's definitely a watch for something that you've already paid the subscription fee for. So yeah, mm-hmm. That's definitely on my to-do list. So yeah, so all in all, like a nice mix of stuff. Plus obviously into July, you know, yeah, we're going to wrap up Strange New Worlds. Westworld is going to carry into this month. We've got a couple more episodes of Ms. Marvel. So this, and then Stranger Things dropped two new episodes this weekend to wrap up season 4. And then on top of that, we've got Umbrella Academy. So there's still a ton of content this month sort of trickling in. I got to be honest, I'm kind of hoping at some point some of this peters out a little bit so you can catch up. You know, like I love the Umbrella Academy, but I haven't even started it yet because there's just so much other stuff to catch up on. So yeah, it's just a lot of stuff right now. But again, not a bad problem to have.
All right. Well, I guess that's it for another week. So I guess, Jonathan, people want to get in touch with you, where would they find you?
You can always find me on Twitter and Instagram as @JPKNews.
And Jaime, if people want to get in touch with you on the Winter Interrupts, where they find you?
I'm on Twitter as @DevWithAHair.
All right. My name is Timitra, TimMitra on the Twitter machine is where you'll find me. And so until next time, we'll see you in the future. Bye.
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 You've been listening to the Spotcast Podcast. If you want to find out more about the podcast or see the episode show notes, visit the Spotcast website at spotcast.com. You can get in touch with us on the website or follow us on Twitter at Spotcast. If you have feedback or questions, send us a tweet with the hashtag AskSpotcast. If you like the show, please consider recommending us to a friend, writing a review on iTunes, or pledging any amount at patreon.com/spotcast. You can find details on how to help us on our website, spotcast.com/sponsor us. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you in the future.
Fairly efficient and painless.
Yeah, it worked out all right, well, except for the little hiccup there.
Yeah, I mean, this is the only time we have to do this one because Tim, you'll be back in Ontario by next week, and
well, no, I'll be driving Friday, Saturday, leaving Friday, staying in Montreal, driving home Saturday.
So, are we going to do next Thursday here?
Are you here next Thursday?
Yeah, we're either going to leave on Thursday or on Friday to go down to Nova Scotia.
Yeah, we could.
Yeah, I mean, we want to miss next week's episode just because it's the season finale of Strange New Worlds.
Finale, yeah. Right, what's today? Today's Saturday, though.
Yep.
Yeah, so you're saying Thursday, right? Gotcha.
Yep.
I follow you now.
You there?
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, I mean, we can continue figuring it out, but maybe we'll do next Thursday. I'm told from upstairs that the natives would like to come back and use the basement, so.
Oh, yeah, okay.
Yeah.
Okay. All right, well, we can talk to you next week. I mean,
until next time, it sounds like Thursday as usual.
Yep.
Yeah.
All right.
I'll talk to you in about 2 seconds, John.
Okay.
Talk to you later.
Okay. Good night, Jaime.
Have a good weekend, Jaime. Happy July 4th.
Yeah. Happy July 4th.
Hey, have a good weekend, too. Right. Bye.
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 Enjoy all your favorite sports like never before at BetMGM. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. When you register with BetMGM, you'll get instant access to a variety of parlay selection features, live betting options, and the best daily promotions in the business. And with BetMGM at your fingertips, every play and every game matters more than ever. Place your money line, prop, or parlay bets with the king of sportsbooks today. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. 21 plus and present in Ohio, subject to eligibility requirements. Rewards are non-withdrawable bonus bets that expire in 7 days. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER in partnership with MGM Northfield Park.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.